of God with us, God not with us, or God abandoning us. And it got me thinking about where I used to be in my life, to where, as agnostic, atheist, not a believer, I remember thinking that if I could be convinced philosophically or you know, scientifically or physically of a creator God, then I would be pretty close to deists. I could probably buy into deism as far as God created the universe and stepped back, because all the evidence in my life showed that he had abandoned his creation. There was only chaos and meaningless in the world. And I'd like to spend this time to show you how I've come to terms with that and how I've reconciled that in my life. And to do that, I'd like to go through the very first Bible study I went through, which has nothing to do with Christmas. Most of you know that it's Jeff Linhart that led me to Christ a few years ago. And it is through Jeff Linhart that I had my first Bible study. If you know Jeff, you could probably guess what book we started in. Genesis. So we are going to go to Genesis in the beginning. If you're taking notes, I don't think I've ever said this, but if you are taking notes, then we're going to go through five narrative cycles. So you can do 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. The first one, and this first Bible study, by the way, is what made me love the Bible, is knowing that it's not just a surface level reading, it's just not a report. There are parallels and little, not hidden gems, but you know, it's just deeper than what's just on the surface level of the text. So in Genesis 1, if you're keeping notes on the first bullet point, your first narrative cycle is going to be creation. God created the heavens and the earth. After that, at the end of chapter 1, the second narrative cycle is what's called the commission of man, where God tells Adam and Eve to be fruitful and multiply. Then after that, in Genesis 3, you get to the fall. This is one of the first things I learned about the gospel in Genesis, is that when Eve saw that the fruit was good for food, and she took of it and she ate of it, that there's really no difference between her sin and every sin since then. We've learned in chapter 1 and 2 that God provides the good, that everything he gives to us is good. And what Eve did was not only disobey God, what she did is she provided the good for herself. She rejected the goodness of God and went to provide it for herself. When God said, "This is not good," she goes, "No, I think it is good." And she ate of it. Her husband was there, Adam, and he ate of it too. After the fall, you have a punishment that's given to Adam and Eve. And you have two curses. God curses the serpent and he curses the ground. But from this punishment of Adam and Eve, God also gives a promise. This is the gospel in Genesis. That there's going to be a seed of the woman who will come to crush the head of the serpent. Then in chapter 4, you have the first seed that Eve arrogantly proclaims that she has provided this seed to crush the head of the serpent. Not explicitly, but it's in there, with Cain. Well, then a short time after that, they have a son, Abel. Then Cain and Abel offer up their sacrifices to God, and God rejects Cain and accepts Abel's. And it's after that that God talks to Cain and says, you know, if you do good, you know, it'll be better. Well, Cain obviously doesn't accept that, and he kills Abel. So your fourth thing on this narrative cycle is called the conflict of the seed. And as we study through Genesis and throughout the rest of the Bible, we'll see that the Old Testament and the beginning parts of the New Testament is very concerned with genealogies. That's because from that promised seed in chapter 3, we can trace from there to Jesus. All of Genesis, every time a father has a son in the main stories, he has two sons, and there seems to be a conflict. Well, this starts with Cain and Abel. There's a conflict of the seed. Who is the promised seed? Well, it's obviously not Cain, because he killed Abel, and it's obviously not Abel, because Abel's dead. So then you have a hope of the promised seed restored in Seth. Adam and Eve were banished from the garden to wander east of the garden. Cain is banished to wander east in the land of Nod, which is really just a really cool translation to where the land of Nod just means to wander. So he's banished to wander in the east. So then chapter 4 begins with Cain's lineage, to where his line gets exponentially worse and worse as they travel farther east, which is a symbolic representation of a farther from Eden, a farthering from God. You see that Cain's line concerns themselves with making metals and weapons. And then at the end, Lamech, who is Cain's seventh descendant, he's twice the murderer Cain is. And not only is he twice the murderer, he repays violence, a harm done, with murder. So his justice is corrupt at this point. And alternatively, you have Seth in chapter 5, where it talks about, with Seth's line, they began to call upon the name of the Lord. And we can see at that point that whereas before, when God would come in the cool of the evening and walk with Adam and Eve, now Seth's line is having to call upon the name of the Lord, showing that God has distanced himself from his creation. There's a disfellowship that's happened. But nonetheless, Seth and his line call upon the name of the Lord. In his line, you have a man that walked with God and then was no more. God took him. And from there, you have the oldest man that ever lived, Methuselah, and then his grandson, of course, Noah, who means rest. So the fifth thing that we're going to study is judgment. That's what happens in chapter 6. It's when the sons of God saw that the daughters of man were beautiful. Sons of God being the godly line of Seth, intermarrying into the ungodly line of Cain. It's not explicitly said in the Bible that that's a sin to do, but we do know that when godly people mix and marry with ungodly people, very rarely does the ungodly become godly, right? It's the godly are dragged down to the ungodly. Charles Spurgeon said that if you drop a white glove into mud, the mud doesn't become all glovey. The glove becomes muddy. So that's what we see at the beginning of chapter 6, is this violence that begins to happen, where God says that I can see in man's heart there's only evil continually. Because of this, I'm going to destroy the earth. And that's where I want to focus on right there, is this judgment that happens. This fifth narrative cycle is something that I had a huge problem with when I would study for Christianity. I would study Christianity in order to argue it more effectively with my Christian friends. It would mainly come down to the science of a sixth literal day creation. It was just unbelievable to me. 6,000 years, like I just couldn't accept that. There were philosophical questions that I would ask and aspersions I would cast as far as how can a good God create women or create children with cancer and they die? Like, how would a good God do that? But then on my more emotional days, when those arguments weren't working, I would go to the flood. It wasn't so much that God killed everyone on earth. I think I could accept the philosophical premise that a creator, hypothetically, if there is a creator, has the right to kill his creation if he wants to kill his creation. There's really nothing wrong with that, legally or philosophically or scientifically. But I really, really hated the idea that God had abandoned his creation. Like, why create? Why put people on this earth if you're only going to abandon them when the going gets rough, as it were? And I would argue this with my friends and family. The biggest argument me and Cassie has ever been in has been over this. As she got the kids ready for church one morning, and as she's getting the kids ready for church, I come home from a Saturday night out playing music and being elsewhere, and just got really mad at her getting the kids ready for church. So we had that huge argument, and rightfully she took the kids to church and didn't come home for a while, which I think began us on our first real path towards marriage counseling and the nudge that I think that brought me to Christ eventually. But I think this feeling, this abandonment, this problem that I have with abandonment, I think I didn't know it at the time, but there's probably some things you need to know about me that would make sense of why I would have such a problem. Can't escape this microphone. So I was born in California in 1988. And before me, my older brother, who's 4 years old, and then after me, 2 years after, was my younger brother, who's 1 year old. My dad was in the Navy, and I'm not sure what he did in the Navy, but I know it put him on a boat for months at a time, or when he was home, he would be on base working. He wasn't home a lot when I was a kid. I don't remember that. I was three. So from what I've been told, he just wasn't home a lot. Well, one night when we were 3 years old, my mother, for a mixture of mental problems and drug addictions, decided she didn't want to be a mom anymore. So she took off in the middle of the night. And there we were, my seven-year-old brother, me as three, and my one-year-old brother. And if not for the grace of God and my older brother, I don't think any of us would be here right now. For 10 days, my seven-year-old brother fed and washed and took care of me and my one-year-old brother. It was only after 10 days when he ran out of formula does he go to the neighbor's house and not ask for help necessarily, just ask for more food to feed Trey. So there we were, goes to the neighbor. The neighbor gets in touch with base, which gets in touch with my grandmother because my father, again, is out at sea. So my grandmother comes out, picks us up, brings us to the Carolinas. It wasn't too much longer after that my father was able to get discharged from the Navy, and he came to be with us. I've never talked to my mom again. She had reached out to me some time ago when Cassie was pregnant with Tristan, or had just gave birth to Tristan. And she reached out on Facebook, and I didn't want anything to do with that. And then I found out last year that she had died. And I didn't go to the funeral, which I probably shouldn't have. But living in the Carolinas with my dad and grandma, it wasn't too much longer that my dad met another woman and got married to her. It was my stepmother. And from her, they have two more children, my younger brother and my younger sister. And she was a mean lady. Through 10 years of mental and physical and verbal abuse that me and my older brother endured, while my father, again, working on the road trying to support his new twice as big family that he had when he started. So we endured that for a while. And because of that, me and my brothers, we leaned into my father. He was our best friend. Being abandoned at such a young age does things to you physically or emotionally and psychologically that, you know, at 10, 11, 12 years old, you have no idea what's happening to you, but you become codependent on people, and we leaned heavily, heavily into our father, and he was my best friend. He was a good dad. He was a great dad, and he did everything together. I remember there were times where I'd go spend the night at a friend's house, and I'd have to call to make sure he was okay. When I would go to football camp, my dad paid a good amount of money for me to go to University of South Carolina to learn under Lou Holtz. And I was there for 2 days before I called home and made him drive 4.5 hours to come get me. And I was like 13. But I was just so scared. And I didn't know it at the time, but I was so scared something was going to happen to him that I would be abandoned. Well, as most of you know, it did happen. When I was 14 in March, we were preparing for me to get my driver's license or my driver's permit. My father decided he was going to take me out to go look at cars. The next month, in April, I was going to turn 14 and a half in North Carolina. At the time, I don't know what it is now. At 14 and a half, you can get your driver's permit. So as we were looking at cars, we spent a great day looking at cars we couldn't afford, and then looking at cars we could afford. Then we went to lunch together, and as we pulled out onto the street into the red light, we were sitting at the red light, and a man who was 80 years old who had no license because he had a history of strokes had a stroke intense stuff. And his 2-ton Chevy hit us head on, going the better part of 80 miles an hour. My stepmom was driving, my younger brother was beside me, and my father was in the passenger seat in front of me. I remember coming to. I was knocked unconscious, I don't know for how long. And I remember looking to my right. Well, I remember at first seeing my father staring at me, and looking to my right and seeing that my brother was no longer there. So I was immediately like, well, that's a dream. Because my brother was here a minute ago, now he's not. It was because he wasn't there because he had been ejected from the vehicle. And as he lay 20 or 30 meters ahead of us, my stepmom was out there, and I just sat with my dad as he was immediately crushed in the chest. His heart exploded, I would find out, and that he was leaned over, and I just held his hand. And at that time, I didn't cry. I was in total shock. Like, my worst fears literally came true that day. I was left without a mother at a young age, and now the only person that I loved in the whole world was dead in front of me. Like, I had no joy. All hope had left me at that point. A month later, my mother kicks my older brother out of the house. Less than a month after his father died, and he joined the army and ended up in Korea. It was less than a year later that I was kicked out of the house. My stepmother just didn't want to have anything to do with it. So I went to go live with my grandmother. And my grandmother, a sweet lady, but she was in her senioritis. She wasn't looking to raise kids. So she had a house at the beach and a house in Rock Hill. And it's in Rock Hill that I stayed at her house while she stayed at the beach. So there I am, unsupervised 15-year-old kid with a house paid for, a car paid for, and really all I had to do was earn enough money to eat. So I began to play music, get a little odd jobs and stuff. It wasn't long before I realized that this hope and this joy that I was yearning for could be found in alcohol and drugs, and you could get alcohol and drugs a lot easier if you're playing music. So that's what I did. Fast forward a few years, I meet Cassie. I'm playing full-time music in the bars and out on these streets. And we meet Cassie, and I knew immediately that she was one for me. She doesn't believe that, but I do know. And when I saw her, I just knew we were supposed to be together. I gave up every other girl I'd ever known and never looked back. That same year that we got together, we got married. It was about 6 months after we started hanging out, we got married, and it wasn't long after that that Tristan came, and it wasn't a couple years after that that Peyton came. But there was something inside of me that still, I just wanted to run. I didn't want to be a part of my own family. I was so scared of being abandoned that I didn't want to invest in them. So I took a job on the road to support this new family that I have, to where I would be gone for 10 weeks at a time all over the country. And I would come home for weeks, or come home for like a long weekend or maybe a week. And that's how we spent 5 years together, is long weekends every 10 weeks. As Peyton began to walk and remember things more, I was like, okay, maybe it's time for me to go off the road and be a better father. So I came home, I got a job in town to where I could be home every day. But I really wasn't home every day because music was still a passion of mine. This joy that I couldn't find in my own family because I didn't want to get infested was still found in manufactured happiness. So that's what I did for a while. I did that for a long while, where I would come home from work on Friday, put the kids down to bed, and then maybe they'd see me Sunday morning. Of course, I'd put that under the guise of making extra money through playing music, but half that money was spent before I even got at home. Of course, the story works out. I'm here. I love my family. I'm not scared of being abandoned anymore. And we'll get to that in a minute. So when I read about the flood and how God abandoned his people, the people that he created, I obviously responded to that viscerally. I hated that story. And I didn't respect people that would love a God that could do that to his people. Then I learned through my first Bible study, through the gospel, of course, that God had not abandoned his people, because there's still Noah and his family. I learned about my own sin. It was only after seeing my own sin could I realize how great sin is. It's like Charles Spurgeon said, if your sin's not great, then your Savior's not great either. It's after seeing how great Jesus was and how great God was I able to see like how truly great my sin is, how truly awful my sin is, how my sin deserves justice. When I would think about before about mothers clinging to their children and clinging to rocks, begging for mercy and begging to be saved, and the waters rose, it would tear me up inside. And it still does. I still have passion and empathy for those mothers and the children that went through that. But then I also recognize that sin deserves that. It was through seeing the grace in Noah that God had given a remnant. He made a promise. That's why he didn't just destroy everyone and start over. Because in chapter 3, he made a promise to man that there would come a seed that would crush the head of the serpent. It was the first sermon I did at the other church was on the flood, where before it was such a visceral reaction. It's become my favorite story. I could talk about the flood for probably hours. And I could preach the whole gospel just through the flood narrative. Might do that one day, but I've got to move on. So God shows grace and mercy to Noah because he made a promise, because of his love for the greater of humanity, the people that would come after Noah, that they would need salvation, and it's through Noah's seed. But what's interesting, the second thing, well, I don't know when I'm at now. It's all the same day that I learned all this. So the third thing, fourth thing, whatever it was that I learned, is that we've got creation, the commission of man, the fall, conflict of the seed, and judgment. After judgment, after the flood, it's really interesting that Noah sends out a bird, a crow or a raven, a blackbird, and the bird hovers over the water. The darkness hovers over the water, and it comes back empty-handed, but then he sends out a light bird, a sparrow or a dove, and it's this symbolizing the Spirit of God hovering over the waters. The dove doesn't come back, and then the waters recede. So what we have is a repeat of the first save, of the first narrative cycle. You have creation happen again. Immediately when they get off the boat, God tells Noah and his sons to be fruitful and multiply. So you have the commission of man repeated again. It wasn't long before Noah got off the boat, and it's hard to blame him after all he's been through. I'm not making excuses. I'm just saying I can understand. Noah plants a vineyard and gets drunk, right? It's one thing to have a bottle of booze laying around and you practice not good will. There's a better way to say it. But Noah went into the field, planted a vineyard, harvested, fermented. He really wanted to get rid of whatever he was trying to get rid of. So you have the fall repeated when Noah gets drunk again. Then you have Noah has Ham, Shem, and Japheth. So you have a conflict of the seed. Remember, we have to follow this seed line out. So Ham goes to his brothers, Japheth and Shem, and say, you know, come check this out. Father's naked, drunk, on wine. So obviously the line is not going to be through Ham because Noah curses Canaan, Ham's fourth son. So that's not where the line's going to come from. We find out that the line comes from Shem, and then later through Abraham and Isaac and Jacob. But what's interesting is the fifth one is not repeated. In Genesis, again, you have creation, commission of man, the fall, conflict of the seed. You have judgment and the flood, but after everything's repeated except for the judgment. When does the judgment come? In the end, after Jesus. So as a reader, when you're reading this, it's been assured to me by people who read Hebrew that it's pretty clear the way it's structured, that you would pick up on this pattern pretty quick. The original readers would know that the two things. They would be chasing this line. They would know that there's this conflict here, and they'd be waiting for judgment. And that's what we do. That's what they do throughout the whole Bible. The whole Bible is just waiting for judgment until you get to the very end in Revelation. That's when judgment happens. So this presents a problem for Old Testament readers for the New Testament. Man's problem is sin. That there is coming a judgment. And that there's nothing I can do to appease the wrath of God. We've got the sacrificial system set up, but we know, David knows, that God is not satisfied in the offerings of bulls. So there's something that has to be done for man. And of course, we find that in the New Testament, in Matthew chapter 1, where he says, "He shall be called Emmanuel, God with us." This is where I started with the other sermons. But it was odd to me that it's like Christmas is the beginning. We celebrate Christmas sometimes, and I hear sermons about this, you know, this is the beginning. It's not the beginning, and it's not the end. This is exactly where God had planned it. The way that people were saved in the Old Testament is the exact same way we're saved in the New Testament. God with us. It is only by God coming down, Jeremiah talked about in the remembrance meeting this morning, that God putting on humanity and coming down was the only way to appease his Father's wrath. The creator of the universe, we believe that Jesus is the one who spoke light into darkness, and that he had the trees come up and the land formed and the birds in the sky. We believe that. And he's the one that put on humanity to come down. He created the hill that he died on, and he created the trees that were made into crosses, and he created the evil men. Well, he created men. They became evil through their own free will. He created the men that were to murder him only because of his love for us. And that's God with us. But it doesn't end there either, because if you go to the end of Matthew, the beginning of Matthew begins with God with us, and at the end of Matthew, right before Jesus ascends to heaven, he says, "I'll always be with you." So God is not with us solely to solve man's problem of sin. God's with us as we continue throughout our lives, throughout the history of the universe. God is always with us. This solves this feeling of abandonment for me. This feeling I've had since a child, of never wanting to really get close to anyone because they're just going to abandon me. The fact that God is with us, has always been with us, and will always be with us, I think is the Christmas story. Cassie was pretty upset that I wasn't going to mention Jesus in a manger, little baby Jesus in a manger. But I think this is the Christmas story, that God is always, always with us. There's a story that I'd like to end with. I don't even know what time it is. The story I want to end with that I learned recently that fits in with this God with us, how we never know what our actions are going to do and what our actions that we do here are going to become. As Sunday school teachers, what is it you teach the kids? What could come from that? There's a story of a man named Edward Kimball in 1850, and he was a Sunday school teacher in Boston. And in the Sunday school, there was a group of boys that were a little rowdy, little rambunctious. And you notice that one of them, when he said to turn to John, one of the more rowdier boys couldn't find John in the Bible. So he walks up discreetly, kind of flips through the pages and gets him to John, and he goes on. Well, the Sunday school teacher had made it a mission that year that he was going to see to it that he could do everything he could do to save the soul of those boys. So he goes to this young man's job. You know, during those times, I guess you could have jobs when you were 11, 12 years old. So he goes to the shoe department, the shoe store that the kid worked in, and he begins to ask him questions. And he begins to weep over this kid's sin. Later on, the kid would say that this man who I barely knew is weeping over the sins that I had not known I had. So it's through this work that Edward Kimball put in, that this young man, Dwight L. Moody, grows up. His college is still in Chicago. He had a broadcasting station. It's said that through Dwight L. Moody's efforts and through the broadcast, his broadcasting and stuff, that over 100 million people heard the gospel. Well, one of these men that heard the gospel is a guy named Wilbur Chapman. He was at one of the revivals that Dwight L. Moody was at, and he led Wilbur Chapman to the Lord. And Wilbur Chapman put in the work and discipled and grew up. He became a preacher. So then he's preaching at a tent revival one day, and he leads Billy Sunday to Christ. Billy Sunday was a baseball player for the Chicago White Sox, and said that at the end of that season, Billy Sunday gave up his professional baseball career in order to be an evangelist. And it's through Billy Sunday's through Billy Sunday's revivals was a young man named Mordecai Ham. Billy Sunday led Mordecai Ham to Christ. Well, Mordecai Ham, same story, he goes on and he's inspired to start his evangelism. So Billy Mordecai Ham is teaching in Charlotte, North Carolina one day. And so a group of boys from the local school decided they were going to get together and they were just going to cause some trouble at Mordecai Ham's revival. So they go there, and two of them decide that they're going to start the trouble, but one of them had heard something that that had kind of stopped him, and it was the gospel. He said he felt as though Mordecai Ham was talking to him and to him alone about his sin and his need for Jesus Christ. So he went back the next night, and he decided that what he was going to do, he was going to sit in the choir loft, so it didn't seem like Mordecai Ham was preaching directly to him. And it's at that point near the altar call that a man came up to Billy Graham and said, "Come down to the altar with us." So it's said that Billy Graham was able to reach 2.2 billion people with the gospel over his lifetime. And couple that with Dwight L. Moody, Billy Sunday, Mordecai Ham, and Wilbur Chapman, I mean, easily 2.5 billion people heard the gospel because of a Sunday school teacher in Boston, Edward Kimball. Well, we know Billy Graham began his crusades early on, and it's through Billy Graham's efforts in the crusades that a man named Barry Moore was inspired to do his own teaching and his own revivals. So he begins doing that. And he leads a man named George to Christ through his tent revivals and his crusades. Well, George doesn't know what to do after the crusade, so he joins up with Billy Graham's crusade to be discipled and to learn about God, learn how to evangelize, how to be a Christian. Well, he led his 4-year-old son to Christ through what he learned at the Billy Graham crusades. The 4-year-old son had dedicated his life to learning all that he could learn, to the knowledge of Christ, and to caring and loving people. And his 4-year-old son goes to different colleges throughout the world and ends up in the Carolinas. And in 2017, he meets a man that feels abandoned by everyone, who hates God. Not just doesn't believe in God, just hates the very idea of him. And on my father's birthday, on May 7th, 2017, that 4-year-old boy, Jeff Linhart, led me to Christ in a Home Depot parking lot. And here we are because of that. 2 weeks later, I was able to baptize my son, my 7-year-old son. Cassie got to watch on as her father baptized me, and I got to baptize my son. And it was a wonderful day. It was awesome. Now, I don't bring up that story to put my name in a line of great men. I bring up that story to bracket great men with my name. That it's Edward Kimball, a Sunday school teacher in Boston, Massachusetts, to me here at Renewal, not knowing what's going to happen with the words that I say or the children that I teach in Sunday school. But I think it's okay not knowing that, because I'm not abandoned by God. God is with me personally, with me and with you and with us. So this Christmas special this Christmas sermon is a little unorthodox, but I don't think we're going to have a New Year's sermon. So I wanted to both say what God with me, God with us meant to me, and also a challenge from Edward Kimball
where he said that you don't know what's going to happen when you teach kids and when every interaction you have with people. You have no idea. It could turn into Billy Graham. It could turn into 2.5 billion people hearing the gospel because you wept over the sins of a rambunctious child. Because Lewis comes up to play us out. I'll close in prayer. Our Father and our God, we're so grateful for who you are, for what you are, for what you've done. When you could have started over with Noah, you could have wiped it out, you could have created people that were not your enemies. You cared so much about us and the free will that we have that you created us anyway. With our free will, you created your own enemies. God, I'm so grateful for your Son, Jesus Christ, who promised to be with us, who promised to be with me, who didn't abandon me as I cursed his name and I blasphemed the Holy Spirit. As I was truly an enemy of yours, you never abandoned me. I'm just so grateful for all that you do. I'm grateful for your Son who came to die on the cross for us. I pray that this time together blesses us and it honors you. In your Son's name, I pray. Amen.